Krishnamurti meeting, Saturday, 30th July 1977.
It has often been said in this room that Krishnamurti and those like him through the ages are a benediction to the world, a blessing on mankind. How does this come about? What does it mean? How is it that they remain a benediction and a blessing on the world through the ages? It is, I think, not merely interesting, but very instructive to explore this question. Primarily because it will enable us to have a finer sensitivity to our own personal responsibility throughout our life in relation to the way in which we live our lives. And of course, as in all these cases, that is to say, in anything with which man is concerned, it is the psychical, the psychological, the mental aspect which becomes very important. In fact, it lies right in the forefront, because it is the sort of mind we have as we are, the way in which our own psyche functions, which brings about the necessary transformation of our whole being and our mode of awareness and consequently behavior in life, which specifically distinguishes man from the other kingdoms of nature. Mind or psyche, as it functions at us, well, it functions at present within us, is the key to it. But just to see that fact, if we do really see it and to accept it, does not mean, therefore, that we shall know something else which we must know in order that our direction in life and the manner in which we utilize our life energy will be the right way for us as individual human beings. This is important. What is there about the great teachers of the past and people like Krishnamurti in the present which enables them to be this kind of benediction and blessing? To put it in another way, we are trying to look into the nature of their minds and their mode of function, which of course is exceptionally difficult. So, let us all contribute what we ourselves see in this matter. to our meeting today. If we are fortunate, we shall have contributed something of exceptional importance. So now, who's prepared to start off?
Well, they seem to have a totality within them, which other people haven't got, and they have the capacity to stimulate or open other people onto a way of a path of completion if they will only follow it. These teachers seem to have something rather special which they seem to bring with them, or their childhood is arranged in such a way that they have the chance to realize a sort of completion before others.
Would you agree that they have a mature, fully developed sense of wholeness?
Yes. Seems to be.
Which will therefore imply non-exclusiveness. Non-exclusiveness of anything and everything. This is important because there are all kinds of uncomfortable problems raised by that non-exclusiveness of anything and everything. It means what we, in our ambivalent way, call good and evil, are both accepted, both naturally included. This is the important point. Not accepted as a matter of principle or because it is the right thing to do, but they just do accept. They are like that. Now, what can be a good many of the implications of that?
Thinking about this, it implies that such a person, Krishnamurti or whoever, is on a completely different level than most of us are, because on this non-exclusiveness, when one looks at it, we are, without any doubt whatsoever, all in our particular ways, shattering off bits of the world that we don't like. The bits that we don't like depends on the individual psyche. But we are always shutting off bits of the world, which we say no to, for one reason or another.
And in that case, he's nothing special. He's the most natural thing. It's we who are something special in our unnatural qualities.
This is bound to be also a very individual understanding, because each and every one of us will respond in our own particular way to whatever teacher is there. And depending on the response and the amount of what Krishnaji calls passion behind our investigation depends a great deal on what the teacher actually means to us. It's a more complex question, surely, than just appears on the surface. I mean, some people will say, well, just to be with Krishnaji in his presence gives me strength, gives me vitality. Another person will respond in a different way, say, well, Krishnaji made me think about this particular thing. It will never be, surely, just one answer. Everybody surely will respond in the way that he or she is able to, along a particular pattern of their individual thought and their individual sensitivity in response.
But all the great teachers must have had this total completion. Their disciples certainly reacted differently, like Christ's disciples reacted differently according to their own temperaments, didn't they? That's what you mean.
That goes without saying. I mean, that is what it surely is the meaning of holy. It's holy, W-H-O-L-E, as well as H-O-L-Y. So that is accepted, obviously.
But I can't
realize person is the whole person that embraces everything and is non-exclusive and all-inclusive. But even so, I feel rightly or wrongly, that each and every one of us will respond
of
with
course.
The same amount of capacity that we have to take in.
What is one of the outstanding points associated with the fact that the great teachers are entirely non-exclusive? They don't shut out or fight against or try to get rid of what we call evil. Now, what does that indicate with respect to the teacher's immediate living process?
Immediate living and letting go. Immediate commitment of everything, every moment, always, and then letting go.
Is there anything more than that, something profounder than that?
Well, surely the wisdom and compassion and understanding the whole world of duality. No separateness.
Something else in connection with their actual living process in the immediate moment.
The time factor.
They don't name things, they don't analyze or fragment things. Is that?
And what would that indicate?
Judge. They don't judge. They don't judge, they love.
They see everything whole. They don't fragment it.
Would it or would it not indicate complete attentiveness?
Oh yes, I took that for granted.
If the attentiveness is complete, then all the processes of acceptance, rejection, taking sides with this against that, are all absolutely out. This is one of the deep meanings of the immutability of the truth, of God, of the Holy Ones, of this state which the Buddha called the unshakable freedom of mind. There is no reaction, therefore, from them. You see, this is one of the supreme signs that one has really freed oneself of all impediments. That the mind, psyche preferably, I would say, is really mature. It's very difficult to sort of feel this in its wholeness. I mean, this power of complete attention is something so tremendous that it would that an unfit person would be shattered if he did experience complete attentiveness at any moment.
Is that what happens perhaps when illness comes, that people are for those seconds attentive and it's impossible, so there's a crack?
It is.
It's impossible to hold the attentiveness, so there's a physical break.
No, but the attentiveness is not there in the ordinary person. That sort of attentiveness, it would shatter it.
Wouldn't it be there at moments? Wouldn't there be moments for everyone of complete attentiveness? Because otherwise we're making a solid and we're not.
Apparently complete attentiveness. It is as complete as is possible for that person.
Yeah, and it's different for everyone.
That means it is not complete really.
But the amount of attentiveness is, the force of it is different in everyone.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. But when it reaches the peak point possible to man, one must always make that proviso. The peak point that is possible to man, it is completely in tune with the universal pulse of creation, in rhythm with it.
Therefore, a great teacher can't be special.
You know how when an army is marching over a bridge, they are asked to break step, otherwise the bridge will break. The individual psychophysical organism is like a bridge. If that bridge, the individual living organism called man, is the perfected bridge, then it is the bridge that will not break down with that universal pulse of creation taking up the life rhythm of the individual through his complete attentiveness. See, there are tremendous things involved in this. We never realize. We can only dimly begin to know that we are receptive apparatus for universal rhythms. The great archetypal universal energies function in us largely unconsciously. We are unconscious of them. And the more you pay attention to religious living, centers within the organism sort of gradually begin to come into tune with these archetypal energies and the way they function. This is why all techniques, and especially techniques like the yogic technique and so forth, make the organism more and more sensitive. You see, colors, sounds, particular patterns which one sees as one moves through life, they all put one more and more in touch with these universal energies, these archetypal forces at work. And if one is not like a trained athlete or person who is skilled in some particular game or other, if one is not sort of prepared to receive them, then they affect us dually, for both good and ill. That is to say, the constructive aspects of these archetypal energies produce constructive results, and the demoniacal aspects, don't translate demoniacal as devilish in the conventional sense, you see, but the disruptive aspects also work simultaneously. It's only the prepared organism which can take both, integrate them, transcend them. The transcending takes place because both aspects are in tune with each other. Supposing there is a factory in which the first process is to do some undoing, some unraveling, and the next process is to take the separate, cleaned up or perfected, raveled parts and then put them together. Now if these two are in accord with each other, working rhythmically in cooperation, you'll get the right product. Otherwise, you'll get a mess. I'm just giving a crude simile to suggest what happens inside us. Now, you consider, for instance, a day like this, beautiful, wonderful. You may go out, as I did this morning in the park, and one is in heaven, just quietly in heaven. Not beside oneself in transports of ecstasy or joy or any such thing. One is just naturally in heaven, and heaven is inside one, and one is part of it all, you see. On other occasions, on days which are as wonderful as this, one may be extraordinarily upset and utterly out of tune with the thing. Why? How? You see the implications of it. The whole of our consciousness, when we are upset like that, the whole of our consciousness is like the highly disturbed surface of an ocean. There are strong winds blowing and there's a storm raging or something like that almost. Because of the winds. The sun is shining, but the winds do it. The winds of desire, the winds of of fear and hidden anxieties and frustrations and all that. They don't come up into consciousness, but they're suddenly functioning within the unconscious depths. See? So, if one can sort of really see into this, and one has to see it for oneself, one can't do more than say a few words which might be helpfully suggestive. This is where this tremendous watchfulness has to be present. Now consider the meaning of watch and pray, for ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh. And what is the Son of Man, the coming of the Son of Man attended with? The release of universal power and strength. Am I ready? All right. Then everything is all right. Am I unready? And the organism is shattered.
Bruce, isn't a great deal of this, as far as I can see, is that we have, with our psyches as they are, we have these blocks built in automatically. We don't see the opposites. We rationalize the opposites away when they're too uncomfortable. And we do this quite automatically. Now, what you're talking about, this energy goes in and the opposites come as they are. In other words,
and try to
the blocks disappear. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what is the cure for it? This is the point. If one bears in mind that it is this attentiveness, without taking sides, this choiceless awareness which Krishna Ji talks of. I mean, he has used the phrase, and of course, all the bandwagoners pick it up, old choiceless and awareness. They haven't got the ghost of a conception of what on earth it implies. The meaning of this choiceless awareness. We gaily still keep taking sides all along the lines because we want our desires to be fulfilled. We are overgrown adults. We are immature adults, overgrown children. You see, we have passed our physical puberty and never even arrived near psychological puberty and maturity. No, we are near. We never really appreciate the tremendous importance of this. That is why we keep on striving to become pure, to live the spiritual life, and so on and so on. You see?
But on this, we all seem to do things in discontinuous bursts. There is no, in one way of putting it, there's no continuity with us. If we're talking about awareness, what do we know about this? Practically nothing. And this is not being pessimistic. For a few seconds, a few minutes here, if we're honest. But there's no continuity at all. Most of the time, complete blanks of porridge.
The dynamo keeps stopping all the time. So we go chugging along for a little while and then stop.
Do you think, as far as there are moments of awareness, that I'm only thinking basically Krishnamurti and Christ, that for them there are moments of unawareness. I was thinking of Krishnamurti talks about the process, which is a very painful thing, and for Christ there was the agony in the garden and things like this. Do you think that that is perhaps their moments of unawareness?
Those are external phenomena attending an inward, associated with an inward awakened awareness all the time. You mentioned the process that Krishnamurti experienced and keeps on experiencing still, you see. But you will notice that in that book, The Years of Awakening, you will notice that he sleeps very little. He's constantly awake, constantly waking up in the night with it. And not only with that, but with those other states too. When the heavenly state prevails, how much does that man sleep? Have you ever thought of that? Jesus and his chosen 12 went up into the Mount of Olives constantly at the end of the day, not to get to bed or to have a special cocktail party at midnight or some such thing, but to pray, to meditate intensely, to be in communion, the most wide awake state. What did the Buddha and his monks do? Through the first watch of the night, the second watch of the night, the third watch of the night, whenever did they sleep then? You see? They did sleep, as a matter of fact, now and again. But you see, there is a great difference between that life and our life, isn't there? There is no mention, as far as I'm aware, of the sort of exhaustion that we feel. We're so exhausted, we just cannot keep awake, we just drop off altogether. Which just tells us where we are.
But honestly, Spirod, they don't have this exhaustion because they don't do the same hard work that we do. Let's face it. it seems to be very sort of hypothetical to think of people like Krishnamurti and Christ or whatever. They have certain experiences. Well, are these experiences something we want to achieve, or we're the object of the exercises that we should achieve them, or something like that? Because it seems to me that if you have a human organism, there must be a reflex action. If you're burnt, you put your hand in fire, you must pull your hand out. Krishnamurti, whoever it is not going to leave the hand in the fire except the evil of the fire, is it? Where are they going to pull the hand out of it? There must be that acceptance of the there must be not a rejection of that sort of physical pain or anything like that of any sort of organism. You have the example of the lamas in Tibet fleeing from the Chinese, allegedly a whole group of allegedly enlightened individuals, but they wouldn't accept what they knew was coming from that. So it seems to me that we needn't that there's nothing. No object we can set out to achieve in this. People may have certain experiences which they can describe in the book. Krishnamurti describes them in the book, this otherness and so on, coming upon him. But his life has been very, very different, according to description, from anything we've had. And he's himself, I think, rejected and didn't accept the life which was mapped out for him. So there was an initial non-acceptance there, from his point of view. So he started off with a rejection. And we all do this. We're all selecting at all times. I can't therefore see that there is any object which we can, or any purpose we can fulfill, or anything we can do to achieve this awareness, this choiceless awareness. There may be certain exercises, or say certain mode of living, which will enable us to live a more balanced sort of existence without being troubled by the ups and downs of life. But it doesn't mean to say we will not reject those aspects of life which will give us pain. Or by the same token, not clasp or go for those aspects of life which will give us pleasure. There must be but if we can just see things in balance, and that too much, too many strawberries and ice cream will make us sick, as it were, and too much of the other thing will, or something which gives us pain, we reject that, then we must strike a path through that. But the organism tells us that if we watch it, and there's nothing very mysterious about that, I would have thought.
But the original question was, if I understand it correctly, what does the coming of a holy teacher or realized being like a Krishnamurti mean to each and every one of us? Now, what you've just said and what we've all said here surely rather confirms the fact that it is our individual response to the teacher and what he is bringing. This is what makes it so interesting, because everybody has their own particular feel about it. I don't want to say idea, because Krishnaji says you have relationships with ideas as well, but somehow the other, for me, it rather confirms how everybody has. We all of us have really tried to understand this, haven't we? And in our questions and our responses to the question, a little bit of as we see it has come out.
With respect to this pain rejection of pain and so on, you see, it is obvious that in our daily life we must just be perfectly sensible. If there is a fire there, you don't deliberately put your hand in it and so forth. You see, you don't deliberately walk under a bus or something like that. It is not purely the passing pleasure-pain stream of everyday life that is the important thing, but the manner in which we attend to everything that comes without psychical reactions. I like this, I want it, I'll keep it. I dislike this, I'll get rid of it, I'll destroy it. This is the important. You see, this is what makes for the completeness. The nature of that attentiveness is one in which there is no like-dislike. You see, it's the psychical aspect which is the important thing. Now, with respect to the physical aspect, we all know that for the whole organism, which means not merely the physical organism as considered separately, but the psychophysical organism, pleasure is indispensable for its good health. That's an indispensable factor. But nature is constantly pouring forth a tide of pleasure onto us in terms of the beauty of nature. Also in nature we see the sort of destructive and the terrible aspect, a painful aspect too, you see. But we cannot deny it, that plenty of pleasure pours into our life all the time if we are attentive to it. If we are attentive to the immediate situation in its wholeness. This is the point. And you see, it's very easy to go off the point. The manner in which we are attentive remains, if it is complete in itself, remains the constant factor. And it is the transmutative power within us. The stream of pleasure-pain, as far as the environmental process of life is concerned, will just go on like that. But if oneself has this firmly established within one, then this benedictory influence from the individual goes out upon the environment. Otherwise we get shattered. We think in terms of responding. But response is quite different from reaction. We inevitably and helplessly react in so many different ways, determined by our likes, dislikes, grasping, destroying, trying to get rid of the dislike, you see. We inevitably react in those terms. But if we really see that through intense watchfulness, if we really see that, then we get beyond that altogether. And then it is not we individuals who respond in the ordinary sense of the word respond. A responding takes place which is inevitably right in itself. It's very hard to see this and accept it. I wonder, for instance, when Jesus cursed the fig tree and it withered, did he, this particular Jewish gentleman, this particular Jewish rabbi, did he get annoyed, angry, disapproving, and cursed the tree? Because if he did that merely with respect to a tree, after all, there are many fig trees, there are all sorts of other trees, etc., etc. If he was like that with respect to a fig tree, how was it possible for him to end up with, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do"? See? You know, it's something very well worthwhile brooding upon or meditating upon, if one can and if one has the urge to do so, the natural urge to do so. The nature of this receptive apparatus, this receiving set, which itself is compounded of universal energies at play. We call them electricity and heat and light and chemical energy and so forth. These are all operative in the body itself. Nervous energy we talk of. Now, what is nervous energy? It is always associated with electrical energy and with chemical processes in the brain and the nervous system. Isn't that so? You see, nervous energy is always associated with that. But then over and above this thing we call nervous energy, there is something which is psychical energy, mental energy. We say, what tremendous mental energy that man has. What is this mysterious thing, mental energy? again, surely it is always associated with the concretest expression of energy, namely that which we call matter and materiality and the material, with the actual concrete brain and nerves and so forth. You see, it's associated with that. Because this is the apparatus through which the manifestation of the transmaterial takes place. And essentially the whole thing is energy. We haven't, in terms of science, explored or understood the total nature of energy. I don't suppose the particular organism called man will ever be able to do that in totality, simply because man, constructed and constituted like this, somewhere, somewhen reaches the limits of all his possibilities. Then a new kind of apparatus, a new kind of being has to be there in order that the even more inclusive manifestation may take place. But if we think of the tremendous possibilities lying within us, without imagining possibilities, don't picture them, because practically all those pictures will be false. You know, that's why Krishnamurti says, you can't picture this, you can't imagine it, don't start, think about it, it's unthinkable. What did they say in the Upanishads? Precisely that. What did the Buddha say? When people talk about their various deep states of consciousness, the jhanas and the samapatis, be careful. Whatsoever they say about it, it is in fact not so. That is, not according to what they have said. It's a shattering thing to read and really to understand. But one can always become aware, shapelessly, formlessly, which means be sensitive in a way which is non-restrictive, because it is non-descriptive. You see all the implications. Where and how the silence meets sound and the emptiness meets fullness. I mean, all these things are not hot air by any manner of means. I mean, they are just hot air and sheer bungum, as a man would say, with great annoyance and even animosity, who has never begun to explore these things. But they are realities. So now, these are not things, come back to one of the things you said, about attaining or experiencing certain things, wanting to experience. You've touched on a very important point there, Jim. The thing is that people, by and large, who are interested in all these things, are always thirsting and hungering for this experience, that experience. They little realize that they are only seeking the satisfaction of their egoism and their vanity. Then they come and tell you, you know, very confidentially, look at you, my man, if you're really worthy. Ah, well, I'll tell you, I think it may help you, you know. I'll tell you what I experienced. Always remember Puck and his supreme wisdom. Lord, what fools these mortals be.
Rose, if I might go back to the thing that you mentioned of, instead of awareness, what we normally experience, reaction to the flow of life, reaction to events, and the way the individual psyche reacts to particular events. Now, to learn this about other people is very simple, comparatively simple. One only has to be with them for a few days or a few weeks, where external stimuli are largely cut off, and you will see, without any judgment, the way people will react, depending on their defense mechanism or whatever it is. The extraordinary thing is one hardly sees oneself doing it.
Oneself. You know why? You know why? Ego.
Yes.
I don't do that. I am beyond that. I am this, that, and the other.
Yes, of course.
It shares reason. You see? Yes. And a peculiarly condescending ego.
Yes.
Sublimely condescending.
Yeah.
There we are. Yes, but that is the me. That is the me. That is Mephistopheles here inside me, enjoying himself thoroughly.
Which in a way will defend itself to the death.
Well, it hardly needs defense, because the me cooperates so happily and willingly with all that. When one really goes through that, you know how here, time and again, Krishnaji says, are you prepared to be completely shattered? Wait a minute, I think in one of the latest bulletins, or the one before, number 31, yes, it is in number 31, I think.
Yeah.
That's the one before. Just be patient for a few seconds. It comes in a where there's somebody asking a question. Which isn't a very nice one.
It's the last one.
Yes. Yes, real beauty must be something other than the beauty of the poet, the artist, the young alert mind, though I am not in any way belittling that beauty. Krishnamurti, is this really what you are seeking? Is it really what you want? If you do, there must be the total revolution of your being. Is this what you want? Do you want a revolution that shatters all your concepts, your values, your morality, your respectability, your knowledge? Shatters you so that you are reduced to absolute nothingness, so that you no longer have any character, so that you no longer are the seeker, the man who judges, who is aggressive or perhaps non-aggressive, so that you are completely empty of everything that is you. This emptiness is beauty, with its extreme austerity, in which there is not a spark of harshness or aggressive assertion. This is the pure yogi. You read the Yoga Upanishads, you'll find all this. This is what breaking through means. And is this what you are after? There must be an astonishing intelligence, not information or learning. This intelligence operates all the time, whether you are asleep or awake. That is why we said there must be the observation of the outer and the inner which sharpens the brain. And this very sharpness of the brain makes it quiet. And it is this sensitivity and intelligence that makes thought operate only when it has to. The rest of the time the brain is not dormant, but watchfully quiet. And so the brain with its reactions doesn't bring about conflict. It functions without struggle and therefore without distortion. Then the doing and the acting are immediate, as when you see danger. I think he has mentioned this before with another element, important element added, which is not here. When you really see through total attentiveness, you also do simultaneously. The seeing and the understanding and the doing are not separate. They are one and the same. There is even physical action where necessary. Therefore, there is always a freedom from conceptual accumulation. Notice now how, when we try to explore these things, how all our conceptual accumulations come out, and how we try to hide ourselves in the presenting of these concepts. It's a very, very interesting thing. We lay ourselves open that way. But if, as a group, we mean business, if the truth, the reality is to flower out, then we must be prepared to burn. You see? And in that burning, one is undestroyed. In that burning and out of that burning, as with Moses in the burning bush, the voice of Yahweh Elohim comes out. The voice of the ultimate truth, the reality. The mandate to deliver from bondage. The mandate to teach comes out that way. Now, it is this conceptual accumulation which is the observer, the ego, the me, which divides, resists, and builds barriers. When the me is not, the breakthrough is not, then there is no breakthrough. Then the whole of life is in the beauty of living, the beauty of relationship, without substituting one image for another. Give up one thought and grasp at, this is a profounder thought. You see? All that is out. Then only the infinitely greater is possible. But now you see, this is what we were trying to consider a few moments ago. This immutable, continuously alive, awake, enlightening transcendence within, in the midst of the ever-flowing, ever-passing, the anicca, becoming process. Then only the infinitely greater is possible. Infinitely greater, therefore beyond comparison. Therefore neither greater nor greatest, but the truth, the infinite, the absolute, the unborn, unbecome, unmade, use any words you like, the immeasurable, which Krishnaji is so fond of, all that comes into being. Why do the teachers, all of them, do speak like this? Because this is the healing power, the creative healing power, where man and his life is concerned. The transcendent heals. Anything else merely counteracts the symptom. But the transcendent heals. And that sort of inspired passage is like the inspired passages of the great scriptures. Otherwise, so much of all the books and the writings and the conversations, it's a good bit of churning, and then suddenly Krishnaji will come out with a thing like that, every word of which is pure gold. It's extraordinary. There is not the slightest waffle there. Not the slightest.
One of the answers to the question, of course, the transcendence
heals. You see, there must have been something. This questioner was asking several questions. They start there, you see, and then ends up that way. There must have been something in the questioner which a person like Krishnaji senses and sees clearly. Therefore, he suddenly shoots it out. And you'll notice that things like this sort of suddenly come like a tremendous flood of what we commonly term blinding light. Come like a flood of blinding light. And this is not Krishnaji responding, but transcendence suddenly enveloping the two together. Elijah in the chariot of fire and dropping his mantle upon Elisha.
Bruce, the sad fact seems to be, and I know Greta has spoken about this quite a lot, is that in point of fact we're practically unwilling to give up anything in the way of pleasure, not only physical pleasure but more particularly psychological pleasure. And if we have a glimmer of honesty, we have to admit that we add this bit of awareness as a small adjunct to our normal life while keeping our normal life fairly intact. Quite apart from anything else, it is so absurd, isn't it? But this is how we...
Look, we can neither really seek nor give up physical pleasure, because this is the natural pleasure-pain mechanism of the body. And that just comes and goes according to the movement of the whole situation. The inevitable, ineluctable, that meaning it cannot be stopped, movement of the actual circumstance from second to second. The whole problem of trying to grasp at, to plan for and obtain pleasure is purely psychological, because that's what you can hold. You can't hold physical pleasure. Today is Saturday, Friday. Yesterday, Friday, early in the morning at 3:30, I woke up, and I don't know why I had the impulse to draw the curtains. And God bless my soul. There on the eastern horizon were Venus and Jupiter close to each other with a splendor and a thrilling beauty which just took my breath away, you know. But of course, I couldn't hold that. I couldn't seek it. I couldn't plan for it. It was moving all the time. It's something which you cannot hold. That was the physical reality of the experiencing of pleasure in this person. You see? And of course, I went to sleep again immediately afterwards. And about just before five, I woke up again. There was considerable light then. I thought, I'll just have a look and see now what's happened. I knew that, of course, it showed, because it was far too light to give the same super thrill, you see. And there they were, a little higher up. And, of course, the sort of pleasurability, the sheer physical pleasurability, which depended upon the intensity of the surrounding darkness and the intensity of this brilliant light of those two planets, you see, was no longer there. But I knew that, therefore, I was the least bit disappointed at this.
But you didn't put your alarm clock on for 3:30 this morning.
No, I didn't. If I put my alarm clock on, you see, and it keeps sounding, there'll be alarming events taking place downstairs to downstairs. Yeah, now you see, this is the sort of thing we have to deal with. That the purely material, circumstantial flow of life is not something to be interfered with, but to be completely attended to remain awake. And in remaining awake, you don't just throw out your attention, you are attentive. And that real attentiveness includes the person attending. So in that kind of attentiveness, the separation between the attender and that which is attended to is out of the situation, then you are very much more in the state of true attentiveness. Otherwise you are not.
I think we all get caught up here so often again in the rupa, in the form of these things. I mean, every teacher, I suppose, who's ever come have had the devout and not so devout and ordinary followers coming along and wanting to be like the teacher. You know, a pale rubber stamp or facsimile of the teacher, which obviously is, as Krishnaji says himself, second hand. It's not your experience. But for myself, I feel a little less pessimistic than Jim does. I think that with attentiveness in one's own life, because after all, it's growth is said so often, and we can apply it to our own lives. We have to follow our own patterns, don't we? You're placed in such and such a position, Diana and another, me and another, Rose and yet another, Krishnamurti himself. So,
yeah.
I mean, this is only being
yes, sure. What I'm saying is, if you attentiveness, okay, you just watch what's happening to yourself, and you know, as I say, if you eat too many strawberries and ice cream, you watch what's happening, you see what effect it has on you. But this, you know, this a bizarre example, as it were. All right, you do that, but one doesn't, and then things are regulated within the organism, as it were, whilst there is this watching
but
what's happening.
That's only but the beginning.
No, not only the beginning, as I see it, it's all, because you aren't doing that so you will have some marvellous experience, you know, a few years hence.
Did you say you are?
No, you are not.
No.
It's everything. Then when there is that constant looking and seeing how things happen within the organism, this attentiveness to what is happening to yourself in all situations, as it were, then everything regulates itself. There is sort of harmony, presumably. I mean, again, that's a speculation. But one doesn't do it because you think you'll have some experience such as Krishnamurti describes, or Christ describes, or anything like that, or the Buddha describes.
That is quite right. What varies with the individual who is attending is the intensity of that attentiveness, you see. there comes the fruition point with anything and everything where the living process is concerned, the point of complete maturity and perfection, the ripening, the full ripening, you see. And this is what makes the particular individual a benediction and a blessing. You remember I started off with that. This is what makes them so. Now, what you say is quite true. But the intensity of that attentiveness is like a third, fourth, fifth magnitude star. It's not absolutely the first magnitude star, the fullness possible. And man's development, man's growth, and the individual man's development and growth, and coming to full fruition, means that the intensity of that attentiveness has to reach its peak point. No one can measure it. You see? No one can measure it. We can consider, because we know ourselves, that we are not attentive in this, that and the other situation. That we are capable of doing wrong. Not only in the ambivalent sense, but in an absolute sense also. In an absolute sense this way, that whatsoever we think, feel, speak and do, which obstructs the process of the flowering of man, individually and as mankind, is wrong. This is the sort of transcendent source of the categorical imperative within us. See? And this teaches us what we are. This, as Krishnamurti says, the me which is obstructing all the time. I mean, you see what he says, when you are completely shattered, and everything is empty and so forth. But in the attentiveness which you speak of, it is perfectly correct, that has to go on all the day long, whilst you are at work, whilst you are relaxing, as we say, whilst you are at the theatre, or whatever it is. See, then it has a self-adjusting process from within itself, there is no doubt about that. But the point is, we rest contented rather too easily.
Fred, why I said that, when Jim, just brought up a very interesting point here, that I guess, but why I said that, what I understand by attention, again, happens for very short intervals. Most of the time, I think with most of us, we're having little internal conversations about this or that, don't like that or do like this, where shall I be in 2 hours' time, I don't want to be here, I want to be somewhere else. I mean, this sort of thing, sort of general psyche. But what, of course, I think one knows one shouldn't have attention for any results of being a bigger and better or anything on the barn or whatever. But attention doesn't seem to be a natural thing, otherwise we wouldn't be here. It seems to be going against the stream. Inattention seems to be the natural thing. So, why is one doing this? I find an impossible question to answer.
It reminds me very much of something that may appear rather trite on the surface, but has got greater depth in it, which I heard before I went away, and probably you heard. It was on Radio 4 at the end of the religious news, which I always find most fascinating and instructive. And it's supposed to have been written somewhere or the other in a toilet, which is part of a church. And it said, "Work for the Lord. The pay is terrible, but the fringe benefits are out of this world." I would like to add that they're both out and in this world. But
suppose partially answering my question about that why, it's a sort of seeing the negative side of how absolutely absurd life is on the accepted pattern of working from the ego. One is dimly seen it for a long, long time. It's impossible. It's ridiculous.
Surely one of the important indications in connection with your question, why is this? One of the important indications is just this, that we are naturally unawake. Yeah. We start with that. Okay. If we were naturally awake, there is no such thing as a developmental process for man. That is the whole point. Now look, there are certain things which we are naturally capable of from the moment we are born. We can suckle our mother's breast. We don't have to develop that power. It is just there, quite naturally. You see? But a man's special developmental process has this fascinating difference from the developmental process of other kingdoms of nature, of other species and so forth, that man takes in hand self-responsibility, that which he begins to see as the purpose of his existence, the lines along which he, as a member of the human race, is evolving, is developing, and the process of his maturing is his responsibility. Nature stops there. Nature stops with the body, the natural processes of the body. It has utilized the whole of evolution through the plant and animal kingdoms to produce this creature now, who essentially has the power to look within and accept a self-responsibility. You see?
The thing that worries me, Jim raised the point earlier on, that initially there has to be a choice. And Krishnamurti, in the passage you just read out, that is this what you want? Is this what you're seeking? Mm. And at some point, surely you have to reject things in order to live the religious life. I just can't get over the thing of not rejecting anything and going on to live the religious life.
No. You see, there you are, you see. What a lot is involved in all this. Look, 25 centuries ago, when the Buddha was teaching, he said, put this away with right wisdom. Put that away with right wisdom. Put that away with right wisdom. Now, supposing you want to be a first-class tennis player, let us grant you have a natural gift to start with. You want to be a first-class tennis player. Then there will be the 1, 2, 3, 4, 40 things which you will cease to do naturally because it obstructs the development of your abilities and skill as a tennis player. Hmm? It is like that. Now, this rejecting is not a rejecting born of aversion. It is, what happens is that you see so clearly what is the needful and what is good and helpful and constructive. You see it so clearly that all the obstructions naturally fall away from you. You see? If, for example, you want to be a first-class runner, you can't smoke 10 packets of cigarettes every day and remain a first-class runner. Quite impossible. Or drink 2 bottles of whiskey. You can't do it. So, you see that, therefore, quite naturally, oh, you say to yourself, no, I'm not going to have this because it prevents the fruition of my
natural athletic prowess. In that sense, there is a rejection.
The concept of the religious life is a very much more complicated thing. It's easy to sort of to measure against your running ability, as it were, but your achievements in the religious life, in inverted commas, are somewhat extremely more difficult.
It's much more complex, of course, because it deals with that most complex of all complex things, the human psyche.
I think that's what I really did mean, Jim, when I said that the awareness, the everyday awareness, allied to the pattern of one's love or one's set of circumstances, I don't know if I'm putting this right, is the thing that is eventually going to produce a relationship with this, that one no longer is even being aware of. That it is part of the, I don't know how to put it, the sort of handling mechanism. That's all wrong too. I think my first sentence was correct, that this awareness is in relationship with the circumstances and the pattern of one's life, which includes, of course, the indoctrination and all the beliefs, ideologies, etc., etc., which one is sort of nurtured in at a very early stage. Does that make it a bit more reasonable?
Could I go back to this dropping away? I was captured something then, I think. Now, this dropping away is not such as taking the analogy of a tennis player, it is obviously not a conscious thing of I saying I will have to give up smoking because I want to be a tennis player. Isn't it that with this degree of attention, the I goes out of the window, and this choiceless awareness is something of this order, where there is no I to verbalize, I'm getting out of depth, but
look, this choiceless awareness means that the root source of psychological conflict in your own brain has ceased. You see? You don't take sides. And it's the brain with its particular concepts, its past experiences, its memories and so forth, its desires and ambitions, which takes sides, you see? And the brain deals with the past. The past not as living now in the present through the transformation process in time, but the mere mental constructs which are dead fossils in the cupboard of memory, you see, on their respective shelves and pigeonholes. This is the point. You get it? You see? So when there is choiceless awareness, you are no longer troubled by all that old rubbish heap that accumulated heap. Then you will say, then, well, what is the use of experience? What is the point about going through this, that, and the other in order to learn? Now look, when you go through this, that, and the other, and you go through it intelligently, you extract the essence of it. Now most people will say, but extracting the essence is a particular principle, a concept, a deep thought, a wonderful something. No. That is the usually accepted extracting the essence. But the profound extracting the essence is that your whole being has developed faculty independent of the mental shapes, the mental verbal shapes you give to that extraction. It's power. It's a faculty which you develop. I mean, when you learn to walk, for example, you are told, do this, do the other. After all, there is a certain amount of all that external something.
When you have learned to walk, all that is out of the window. You're no longer hampered by what you've been told. You see, you just do it naturally. Look, C.B. Fry, you know, the famous batsman, he used to tell me that Ranjit Singhji had an extraordinary ability this way. He said, all of us, we learn the art of playing strokes, see, you see, and then we remember what we have been told and we try to do what we've been told. Very few of us get beyond that. Now, Ranjit Singhji was such an extraordinary fellow that having sort of learned through being told, etc., that it became second nature to him and all the telling was of no avail. There was the bowler, there came the ball, four. You see? And he had an amazing ability apparently just to tip the ball, you know, the tipping, and of course you're always caught in the slips. Well, no, he did it with such skill that it always went over their heads. I mean, there you are, you see. It's fantastic. That is the difference. This thing which is faculty, which has become natural second nature to you, means a fruition has taken place. The true maturing is there. And it's a living thing and does not need the external thing of concept and words in order to bolster it up.
By the same token, Philip, it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting point you make about the natural ball player, as it were. You know, I'm interested in golf and so on, and I still see this, people who are naturals and people who strive to master a technique, as it were, very, very, very badly. By the same token, we may say that, you know, Krishnamurti and so on has this natural aptitude, if you like, for awareness, as it were, which he then seeks to conceptualize for our benefit, as it were. No techniques are necessary. They aren't necessary if you're a natural, because you've gone beyond, you've transcended technique. And this is the great difficulty. He never says how. You don't ask me how to do it, as it were, because techniques are not necessary, as it were. But it always does worry, at least this is my own feeling for people, the fact that no technique is given by him to achieve this awareness and so on. But for us lesser lights who aren't natural, it seems to me that maybe some technique is going to be useful, and we must accept it in this light, what he says.
That is true, and it's a very important and a difficult matter. Here is a pair of eyes in my head. You see? The eyes will perform their natural function of their own accord. But I will actually see an object in the real sense of the word see only if, whilst the eyes are functioning properly, that is, looking in the direction of the object, you see, which is sending out reflected rays of light, etc., I pay attention to the object, then I see the object. Supposing my attention is completely captivated by some memory working or some fear suddenly operating, my eyes may be pointing in that direction, but I shall certainly not see what on earth is happening. Isn't that so? Now, the eyes will naturally see. The power of attention will naturally work only when that which obstructs the power of attention comes in the way. Except when the power of that which obstructs attention comes in the way.
Now, when my eyes were looking in that direction, and I did not see the object, the obstructing thing was this memory or this fear or this complete absorption in something else. So, all that I have to do is to attend physically. Ah, now, I see a lamp there, I see a tantra there, and so on and so on. I'm attending to it, therefore I see it as such. Now, in the same way, attentiveness will play its part if we remove the obstructions. Now, what are these obstructions? The preoccupation of the psyche with all its, the pursuit of its desires, its ambitions, its plannings, and all the rest of it. And this is where sense pleasures and the deliberate seeking and accumulating on planning for sense pleasures has the most powerful obstructive influence. It's not that the pleasures of the senses are evil in themselves, not a bit of it. If we didn't have a proper quota of right sense pleasure and the right attention to them, you see, you're going to suffer ill health. And no one spoke so much in detail and so powerfully about sense pleasures as the Buddha did. And after him, I think Krishnamurti he's not quite so insistent or strong about it. But no one, the Buddha or Krishnamurti, prevents the natural flow of sense pleasures into consciousness, as they just come naturally to you from life, and they don't grasp them, they let them pass by. This is the important thing.